night. A harmony break.
Yo, yo, yo. Ace of Space Radio. And I can't hear myself on these headphones. Hey, Doug Pierce is in this. What's up, Doug? That's 2,000 men.
Nobody knows who that guy is.
A little guy named Ace Frehley. Okay. Try that.
Check.
Nope, that ain't it.
Check. Hello.
Testing. Ein, zwei.
Check,
test. Go again.
Check. Green cable in.
No. Try the purple one.
Check.
There you go.
All right.
We're
purple
in.
Cable in.
Purple cable.
Green cable doesn't work.
All right. Yeah. So, boys and girls, we're back with another edition of Ace of Space Radio. My guest today in studio is a well-known fella. Perhaps you've heard of him, Mr. Doug Piercy.
Hi.
Now of Blind Illusion, but he's been in Heathen.
Yeah,
you've been in Anvil Chorus. You've been in... How many fucking bands have you been in anyway?
Well, I guess it's like Andy Gallion said it best. He said we're all lifers at this point.
Yeah.
And so, like,
all that means is that that's what we do. We do music no matter what we try to do on the side or whatever else we're interested in. We always come back to it. So
yeah.
So how many bands? Jesus, it's like...
Tell me.
It's like guitars. I don't even know how many.
Right. So tell me, let's go back to the beginning. Let's rewind all the way back to the beginning when you were first starting out. What were the, first of all, the bands that inspired you?
Well, back then, that was the early 70s, yeah. I guess. So,
and know, where did you grow up? You're here from the Bay Area. You've always been here.
Third generation San Francisco.
Wow. Nice.
Right in the city.
A rarity.
Well, I don't know. I don't even know what to say. It's just, you know. I mean, my Wi-Fi, the signal, if you look and see the Wi-Fi that comes from our house, it says SF Native.
There you go.
No one else can top that.
Exactly. Fact. That's a fact. So you're born here, and when did the music thing start to become...
I don't know. That's a very interesting question. I mean, I'm going all the way back. So, like, when I was little... my dad had this tape player, and he made his own tapes. It was a little concertone two-track, and you know, he had a really beautiful, standard. Well, it wasn't actually standard; it's pretty audiophile. It's made in 1962. It's an Empire turntable, which I still have and still play today. But the point is that we had a lot of records then, and I was really gravitated towards the music. I don't even know why or what, but just it was interesting to figure out how to get onto dad's tapes and find, you know, all the unusual music he was listening to, a lot of the Doors, Kingston Trio, all sorts of strange stuff back then. You know, I was just listening to it. It was interesting. It's like, whoa.
Yeah. I think my dad was the same way. He had a very eclectic record collection. So he would have the Beatles, the Stones, Nina Simone, Bobby Darin, Bob Dylan, you know, and he had a really interesting taste in music. Yeah, doesn't play an instrument.
Dad was into Dylan. Yeah. He would like write all the lyrics down. He just got into it. You know? It was interesting. But one thing led to another, and I slowly started getting more into the harder stuff. I just kind of, I don't know, something got me there. I mean, you know, we grew up on the Beatles, and the Beatles were in the house all the time playing. And it was, and I was, I really cut my teeth on that crazy White album, which was so experimental, you know?
Yeah.
I was trying to understand what the hell they were trying to do, and I still don't know today, you know?
Yeah.
But it was an interesting thing for a small young kid who's learning about music to get involved in, you know? But, you know, then we had Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, come back and kind of bring things back to the norm, mm-hmm. and the Rolling Stones stuff. And then I don't know, my friends had, like, Santana records and... I remember the Who Live at Leeds came into the picture. That was a real powerful one. That was killer. And I still love it.
Yeah.
And the Jimi Hendrix Band of Gypsies in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just thinking back then. And then, of course, the most important Black Sabbath records, the first ones. And Led Zeppelin was out around the same time.
Yeah.
So like, it was an interesting time.
And Deep Purple for me.
Deep Purple was all over my thing. Because I really got into that Made in Japan thing.
Love that record. It's my favorite
back
one.
Back then, it was funny. It was like, it was all about live records. So,
yeah.
Who's got the coolest, best new live record? You know?
Right.
It seemed like that was the hot thing. So, like, you had everything from Peter Frampton to Made in Japan to Humble Pie, Rockin' the Fillmore,
Kiss Alive, of course, is one of the greatest.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many excellent...
Aerosmith Live Bootleg, Ted Nugent.
Nah, not that one, but...
You don't like the Live Bootleg?
Nah, it wasn't as important as those others.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was nothing like Deep Purple improvising on stage.
Incredible.
That's truly unusual.
A live record. I mean, there is truly, no overdubs.
No overdubs. It's super cool because of that. You know, I mean, and then later we had our process, Judas Priest live. Unleashing the East.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah, that's
super. Our favorite.
That's when I saw
record.
Them. They opened up for Kiss that year.
Kiss. The first Kiss live.
Right.
That was a good one too.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it's still, you know, it's just timeless. All those records are timeless. Frampton Comes Alive still is a timeless record.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I mean, he used interesting guitar effects on it, and it was, you know, that crazy talk box thing.
Mm-hmm.
I liked his, like, chorus sound that he got. That was kind of like a Leslie. It was unusual.
Yeah, fantastic, you know. I mean, unfortunately, I've never seen Peter Frampton play live.
I saw him a bunch of times back then.
Did you?
You know? I mean, I'm one of those weird, unusual little kids that remember. I was one of the kids in Winterland, so I saw a lot of bands in Winterland.
What's the first show you went to? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember exactly. It was Eggs Over Easy opening. Canned Heat was the second band, and Quicksilver Messenger Service was the headliner.
Cool.
And
that's a good line.
That's when I saw Dino, whatever, what's his last name? The singer, just...
Dino, I know who you're talking about.
He was pretty amazing singer, and then, of course, the unforgettable John Cipollina.
John Cipollina, yes.
With his bizarre amp setup.
Yeah.
That was really a sight to see.
A lot of people don't think about Quicksilver Messenger Service as part of that scene anymore. They're kind of overlooked. Everybody's a Jefferson Airplane, blah, blah, blah. You know, and the Dead, of course, and that psychedelic scene. But the Quicksilver Messenger Service were very important.
I'm sure it's like that with many, many scenes, you know,
sure.
Like jazz stuff or like just the, you know, what was going on in New York at the time.
Yeah.
You know, there were bands that came out, you know, like rhythm and blues stuff.
Mm.
That were really good, but they didn't leave a somewhat indelible mark on the entire scene, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, I mean, we could easily cite a lot of bands from the Bay Area who were important in the growth and the later spreading to the entire planet of Bay Area thrash metal, who are overlooked now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's everyone has their say in the matter. It's just, you know, how much say depends on who you're talking to.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's kind of freedom of speech. It's fully okay.
So when did you pick up guitar?
Back then. So I don't know. I think I was 13. And
seems to be the age, 12, 13, 14, I get all the time.
12, 13. I mean, my mom put me into this little guitar learning procedure thing that was, you know, like lessons down in West Portal. And, you know, it was horrible. It was like, you know, the Mel Bay book of how to play. Like,
yes, I had one of those.
You know, all E chords and D chords, you know, this campfire songs.
Right,
like, no, thank you.
That's why not, I don't play guitar.
I need to, like, watch Jimmy, you know, Ritchie Blackmore smash shit up or Jimi Hendrix burn some guitars. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's what needs to be happening.
Yeah.
Not this.
Right.
And Jimmy was great, you know. He'd hurl his strats right through this Marshall cabinets and destroy speakers, and his grill cloths are thrashed and ruined. And meanwhile, Richie's like blowing his stuff up on stage with fire and flames. You know,
incredible. God,
that was awesome.
Showmanship.
Yeah, you know, the Kiss thing back even before Kiss.
Yeah, exactly. And then Kiss brought it to a whole new level, and Alice Cooper too.
One of the first songs I learned was, you know, I mean, there was some early Black Sabbath stuff. But the one I really tried to learn the most was this song called Bitch by Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Which is actually pretty complicated and a tough one for an absolute beginner to figure out.
But yeah.
It took a while, but I figured it out.
I don't think that's in standard tuning.
It's like a pentatonic scale or something. It's pretty simple. You know, it's like pretty easy to play with your pinky or with your ring finger and first finger. Pretty straightforward. But, you know, you got to be all over the strings. It's not just one string. It's not like, dun, 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 dun. Anybody can play it on one string, you know? No, I go complicated right away. It's been the bane of my existence.
Yeah, well, I don't think people give enough credit to Keith Richards as an amazing guitar player. He wasn't a great lead player, but he was an amazing rhythm player.
To me, at this point in my life, it's not even about... you know, lead playing or
right.
It's about who writes the songs and how to get the parts executed and played well. I don't even care what they are anymore. It's like, it's just like some heavy chords or feedback noise, or if it's like some singing melody that's harmonized on 3 points that come in, or just those 3 notes or whatever. It's all the beauty of putting, it's like paintings. It's, it's artistic stuff at this point. You know, I mean,
right.
Of course shredding plays a role too, but
yes. But
in the big picture, it
has to have its place.
Exactly.
You know?
In the big picture,
shredding just for shredding gets boring.
Well, yeah, but you know, just playing big majestic notes gets boring too.
Right. It's all about how you mix it up, and it's a gumbo, right? It's a sonic,
exactly.
Oral gumbo, I think.
Kind of being able to sit back and pick and choose and figure out how to what is the best for the song and ultimately for the listener who wants to hear it. You know?
So you pick up guitar in your early teens, let's say, and when did you form your first band?
Well, there is attempts to try to get together and jam, you know, uh-huh. you know, like
in the garage or the basement.
Yeah, you know, where you just go in the garage and you get together with a couple guys and you just basically suck, you know.
That's where everybody there starts.
Many, many quasi rehearsals that are super suck rehearsals, but you know, I mean, there's never any real band put together until maybe later. I think I was about 16, and we actually, me and Bill Skinner, who was eventually in Amble Chorus, he was a friend of mine in the neighborhood, and we put together this thing called Delta, and then we changed it to Cobra because we thought it was heavier sounding.
We could steal
the emblems off the cars.
Yeah.
So like, here we are out at night, you know, we find these Cobras where they had these really cool emblems, and we're like out there with our screwdrivers, and, you know, ripping off our cars, and this is so stupid. You know, how many
times
the
stuff we did when we were kids.
Oh, God.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Oh, man. What is a good idea? I mean, that's nothing, man.
Right?
We're just touching the tip of icebergs.
Oh, man,
here.
You don't even want to know.
I mean, you know, there was like the times when everybody would like carry their jumper clips to high school because they wanted to show the other guys how cool they were. What they did after school every day was steal these kind of Mustangs, you know?
Yeah.
Because the cable link was corrected. You could go directly from the battery to the solenoid. And
right.
So, like, when we had the right... I mean, it's like my buddy is like, well, that's pretty cool, but you know what? My jumper cables are... They're so much better than yours. He goes, really? Let me see. So I come back the next day, and they're all soldered up.
Oh.
And they're all wrapped up with really nice tape, and it was killer. And it's like I was the cool guy for 10 minutes. And then that leads into the actual act of removing these cars from their owners. And,
yeah.
Oh, man, bad stuff.
Bad, bad, bad.
Those are all crazy
youthful shenanigans.
Yep.
It was a different time, though, like, you know.
It was. It was a very different time.
Yeah. It was bad stuff, but done by good kids. It's not like we were bad people. We just did stupid things.
We just did crazy things.
Yeah.
I mean, at least for me, it was always involved a lot of thought and planning.
True. Well, you didn't want to get caught.
Well, that was just the car aspect. Yeah. There was many others.
Is, of course. You don't have to tell me.
So, I don't know. So, those were the two stupid, super suck bands. And then... I started hanging out. So Bill got involved with this band called Leviathan. And I'd go over and hang out and watch those guys rehearse. And they were actually rehearsing. It was pretty cool. So they had real songs and a lot of them. And they kept. And Aaron Zimple was playing guitar in the band.
Bless his heart, by the way, to Aaron.
What?
Bless his heart, Aaron Zimple. We miss him.
Bless everyone's hearts. Bill isn't with us.
Yeah.
And Aaron isn't with us. These are super... important people in my life of, you know, being involved with music because they helped push this envelope farther. We all did. We all pushed the envelope for ourselves farther, and I owe a lot to those guys forever.
Yeah.
But they had this band called Leviathan, and it was a big, massive Rush meets Judas Priest kind of thing. And it was incredible to watch them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, another live album, you know, the Rush, All the World's a Stage.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit.
Incredible,
you know,
yeah.
That was super necessary.
You can curse, too. You
and
can
I
say bad
I
words.
Tried to figure out how to do it. That was the first time I actually not only figured out the songs, but tried to figure out the effects.
Right.
So you can get the effects set up right.
Right.
I mean, Lifeson was using... He was so experimental that it got really interesting to try to figure out how he was doing it. And so then we started playing around with echoplexes, and we got a bunch of those and started experimenting with time and getting them to, you know, regenerate and explode. It's all tape. So
tapes,
it's really
yeah.
interesting kind of like a vibe. It's nothing like a digital delay today.
No.
But, yeah, and Leviathan, they kind of imploded after a while, but they wrote a lot of songs that went on to become... involved with the whole Amble Chorus stuff. So
right.
our set actually encompassed a lot of reworked Leviathan songs. And the Amble Chorus thing came later. I was playing with Thane Rasmussen in an early version of the Amble Chorus thing. And Leviathan had broken up and they were trying to continue on. Aaron and Bill were continuing on doing this project of theirs called Vienna. But then they had trouble with their drummer, and we had our drummer... No, wait. No, that's right. They got Kenny back from Leviathan. And then we all got together, and it was our two guitars, Thane and myself, with Bill on bass and Aaron on vocals. And then we had Kenny on drums. And then we just suddenly had all of the music we'd been playing from both bands,
mm-hmm.
put that together, and that was Animal Chorus. And the timing was right. It was right around the Metal Mondays. And so we got involved with Tony Isabella and mm-hmm. Queenie Taylor and the BGP people that were running
yeah.
the old Waldorf. And eventually, later, it became Wolfgang's. But we managed to be in the right place at the right time and got all involved with that. And it was pretty cool. We actually got to open for Motley Crue, which was kind of like, whoa, really?
Nice.
But we did. There are posters to prove it.
Yeah.
And
I've seen some of those, yeah.
Yeah.
When we did Bay Area Godfathers, a lot of those early
flyers.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I think that was in the movie.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
that's
it's
cool.
It's in the movie, yeah.
I mean,
which is cool for me, you know.
I look past a lot of stuff. I don't really, I mean, it's important in the big scheme of things, but it's nothing I dwell on, you know.
Yeah.
I just kind of, for me, it's way more important to just continue being in the here and now and moving forward rather
right.
than sit there and only hang out in the past and, like, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
You know, celebrate what I did like 1,000 years ago. So no, no way.
Because you're
man.
Still a creative entity. You know, you're
yeah,
still.
Yeah, well, you got to move forward.
Right, right, right.
You know,
right.
there
I mean,
is no
all,
moving back.
Right, right. Everything that you did in the past informs what you do in the future.
Yeah, it can yeah. be looked at that way.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know. But you've yeah. had a lot. You've had a lot of success, and you've had a lot of great bands, and done a lot of cool stuff, and that's the foundation of where you're at now.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, sometimes I look back. You know, and I say, wow, really? What really was so valid? But then apparently, you know, I mean, ask that to all the other people that send me emails and letters and text me on Facebook Messenger and all this. Jesus,
yeah.
these people are in it. They've been dealing with this stuff forever. They bought all the tapes back
right.
then, and they never forgot.
No.
And everybody wants to know now, and everybody's starting to figure out that I've been transferring all those tapes in the 80s to digital, and
oh,
they're
yeah?
all on my Pro Tools machine at home now. And they're getting kind of excited. So here I am talking about it on the radio. Oops, fail.
Yeah.
But
well,
you know what? I don't care. I mean,
is that something that will see the light of day? Will
it'll
see
become
more?
Public domain. Who cares? You know? Isn't that better than, like, if they just rot away and die?
Well, put it out there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
I mean, you got to get it out there.
There's some unclear plans on how to proceed with all that, which I don't even think we should discuss and figure out, because
mm-hmm.
it's sort of it comes down to licensing, because they're
yeah.
owned by myself, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Since I had the machine, recorded all the stuff, and bought all the tapes, you know, it's like, and people have come and gone, disappeared. Anyway, the tapes are still there,
right?
And they happen to be in my possession, so you know, I've managed to clean them up and put them right onto Pro Tools, and they exist now. So now what? I'm not going to sell them, but why not license them?
License them for sure.
So that's kind of where we are.
There you go.
And with that, that's about all I want to talk about it right now. Because
okay.
there's people, there. It's going to come out, and there's going to be, you know, these. I mean, we have many projects too. Some
right.
are discussable. Like the Mordor demos, I haven't talked to them about
right.
and cleared that all up yet, or even gone into.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like the Heathen stuff, which I have.
Mm.
I have the Exodus Church Street demos, which
ooh.
Are like an ooh thing for some people.
Yeah.
They're pretty junky, but they're still cool.
It's still cool, man. Because
but whatever, and they're not going to remain forever on degradable tape. And
yeah.
at some point, we'll figure out what we're going to do with them.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like one thing I do in my side time.
Right.
Now that I have the studio all set up,
mm-hmm.
that's good. That's moving.
I hope that stuff does see the light of day for the people who, from the area and
yeah.
for fans all over the world. Because there is some kid out there in
there
South
is.
America who's going to want to hear
there
that.
There is.
Seriously.
There is.
Yeah.
And I swear up and down by it, and my heart goes out to all of them. I mean, I have been contacted by people from Chile,
mm-hmm.
from Argentina,
yeah.
from Brazil, from Colombia.
Yeah.
And then not only there, but, you know, then there's like in the Asian portion.
Yeah.
Singapore, Japan, lots of stuff from Japan.
Right.
You know, nothing really yet from China, but who knows?
Right.
India,
yeah.
I mean,
it's interesting,
crazy
though, how
the
that,
internet did it.
Yeah,
you know?
but even before then, if you think back, a lot of this stuff was making its way in the old tape trading days. You know, that's how.
That's
it,
true,
right? So there's always been this undercurrent of stuff that people get to each other, like, dude, you got to check this out. You know, here's this band. Now, later on, here we are, two generations later, practically. And the new kids are finding this stuff, and they're going, whoa, this is amazing. I mean, to you, you recorded it 35 years ago.
I know, it is an amazing thing to yeah. sit there and just kind of just be amazed at the enthusiasm. I mean,
yeah.
Again, like I've always said, you know, I just kind of tend to not really want to dwell too much in the past. But right. on the other hand, holy shit, when they find it and things go the way they do and they start asking you all these questions, and you have to actually dig into it and kind of figure out, wow, that's amazing they actually thought about it that much to mm-hmm. formulate all this stuff. I mean, the interviews mm-hmm. that we get to do,
yeah.
I mean, Biederman gets it just as bad as, if not worse than me.
Right.
I mean, he's – because they had – the Blind Illusion thing back then was all about – like, they would release everything. They would record these goofy demos and stuff that are, like, you know, halfway done and or relatively polished stuff, but a lot of them. And mm-hmm. and only three pieces of them, and then they come out on the Trilogy of Terror, and there's many other versions of stuff. And, I mean, it's complicated. I don't even know how to even get to it, but Mark knows.
Uh-huh.
You want to find out all the details, he'll, like, encyclopedia you right into right into shape. It's like, I'm not even going to go there. I know about, since I started working closely with Mark in 2017, I can tell you about from then on.
Right.
But now I don't even want to touch the old stuff.
Right.
Because it's kind of like his thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, we were back then, we were just colleagues, you know,
right.
playing with all the other bands around, the Testaments, Exoduses, and everyone.
Yeah. You know? Is it now interesting, though, to think that when you guys were in the thick of this and you're just out there trying to create great music and trying to, you know, a little bit of competition, but not, you know, friendly competition. Like, you wrote that song? Check this out. You know?
Yeah.
But you guys are pushing each other, and that made the music better. And then that made it get out there to the world. Everybody's going, wow, look at this. You can see the progression of, you know, from one record or one recording to the next. Like, you guys are really pushing the boundaries.
It's not unlike the development of, like, a computer chip or mm-hmm. or a lot of technology. I mean, Samsung was obviously influenced by Apple,
mm-hmm.
and same thing with car stuff. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, Toyota might have.
You build on what came before.
Yeah, exactly. So mm-hmm. like Toyota obviously looked at Porsche for some things,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, like, and these things just ramp up and they keep getting better and improving themselves mm-hmm. to the point of where new cars are so cooler and so well thought through that they don't really break much. You know, they figured out what kind of metals to use. It don't corrode, it cause a defect. Same thing with chips. Same thing with that riffing.
I mean,
we were like all over the riffing. When Metallica came onto the stage around in 1983 or whenever it was, mm-hmm. you know, we're all over that. Same thing with Malmsteen. I'll never forget it being at the Waldorf the first time he came up and just blew everybody's mind away.
You know?
No one ever heard anything like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, much the same way, like when one of my big awakening days personally was being at Day in the Green in 78 when Van Halen came out.
Yeah.
That blew my mind so far away. That's probably the A1 mind-blowing concert of my whole life because of everything it represented was kind of like where things were going to go.
Right.
And everybody knew it right then when they saw it.
Sure.
And it was killer, you know. But then, you know, things ramped up. And then the 80s turned into a huge, massive, massive development of everything from amplifier techniques to overdrive techniques to palm muting to, you know, everybody suddenly went from never using their pinky to using their pinky everywhere mm-hmm. all the time. And mm-hmm. stretching became a big deal. And right. then, like, you know, tapping became the techniques. But for me, you know, it was a lot of other stuff. I mean, you know, the showmanship stuff was important. But it's always important to have killer riffing and good songs, you know. So, like,
yep.
I'd always, like, hang back and say, okay, you guys are over there in the corner doodling and fumbling around with all this other crap. I'm really picking up on how tight this rhythm picking is, and it really is, you know, it's four guitars. How do they do that?
Yeah.
Well, you use headphones and...
And then you're getting super analytical, right?
You get super analytical. Wait, I gotta
put that back. Let me check this
and you, when you microscope that whole situation in a recording arrangement that tight, and you super, I mean, it is very much like microscopic. And you hear every last little squinch and squeak and gook and mm-hmm. smash, mm-hmm. you know. And then you double it.
Right.
And it's an insane thing when it all gets perfectly figured out, you know. And then you play it back and it's like, holy shit. It's just like...
Massive.
It's just massive. So, like, that happened with the Metallica stuff. And then we picked up on that whole technique, you know, with the heathen stuff,
mm-hmm.
and started using that same, you know, production style,
mm-hmm.
which I never has gone away from me. I still do it today. I mean, incessantly and absolutely.
Multi-tracking guitars.
Yeah, but perfectly, or as good as you can possibly get it. Sometimes right. it's just like, holy, how did I do that? You know? And then it's like... And then you have to figure out.
I pulled that one off. I don't know how, but it
is. You're the best you can do. You know, yeah. I mean, no one says that anyone's the best. You know, I just know how. I know that it'll never be good enough for me.
Right, and that's probably a good thing because then you keep pushing yourself and
exactly.
keep trying to do better exactly. every time out.
I mean,
but that's also a curse. Like
it know. Is. Blood pressure goes up. Life expectancy is cut.
So I'll tell you what. Why don't we take a quick break? We'll play a little Heathen. Got some
Heathen
queued up here, and we'll get back to it in a couple. We'll play a couple songs and take a break here, and we'll get right back
Sounds
to
good.
It. So we'll just lead off with "Empire of the Blind." That looks like a good one.
Okay, good. I didn't have anything to do with it.
1.245 million plays on Spotify.
Well, that's good. Good for them. Good for Cragen.
All right, here we go. Ace of Space Radio. I'm here with Doug Piercy of Heathen, Anvil Chorus, and Blind Illusion, etc. hang back. Check out some Heathen. We'll be back with you in a sec. We're back. Ooh, that was nice.
Yeah, that was brutal. Some new heathen and the old stuff that I was on.
Mercy is no virtue was the last thing. And that, what you hear, that kind of galloping, which reminds me a little bit of a little Iron Maiden-ish stuff in there, that sort of galloping feel, which I always loved about Maiden. You know, was Maiden a big influence on you?
Yeah, to some extent, especially the old stuff.
Right.
I mean, when in the old days when we were starting to get into the European metal, you know, we were right in the middle of the new wave of British heavy metal. So, like, we got the metal from Mother's record, mm-hmm. and there was a big interest in, like, Angel Witch and mm-hmm. Iron Maiden. They were probably the big winners on that one. Praying mm-hmm. Mantis was on it.
Praying Mantis is another good one. I love that.
But then that just garnered all sorts. That just pushed interest levels really high for Ron Quintana and all of his crazy buddies. He was running off tapes of this stuff and giving it to everyone.
Yeah.
And so I would always, you know, call him up and torture him and beg for my latest, greatest mixtape from tape. Who knows. I mean, he was like way into the pen pal tape trading thing, so
right.
he'd get stuff before anyone. And amazingly enough, Aaron Zimple's brother, Ben Zimple, was equally interested in all this stuff and worked at a record store and was able to get a lot of it directly from, you know, as they were sending to the import
get
section.
Imports, yeah.
Yeah, in the import section of his store. Mm-hmm. And he takes stuff home and start playing it and say, hey, Aaron, what do you think of this? So, like, Aaron had, like, the fast track in on all of it. So I was either hanging out with Ron or trying to hang out, or I'd be over hanging out at Aaron's house upstairs in Ben's room listening to everything from, you know, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest to Uli, you know. Aaron turned me on to Scorpions.
Nice.
I even brought down an Uli record.
Yes,
we'll
throw that on now.
These are really innovative, interesting times. Right around the end, it was end of 70s, early 80s. Amazing period, and super interesting for everyone in the Bay Area too, because, you know, we weren't the only ones. There was people in the East Bay, like, you know, Kirk Hammett did it, mm-hmm. Gary Holt got involved, mm-hmm. and we started just learning about, you know, we were graduating from UFO.
Right.
To Iron Maiden.
Right.
You know, so, like, it was interesting to see who these kids were. They're all, like, covered in, you know, like, bullet belts and leather stuff. And, you know, I mean, even Def Leppard was awesome.
Right.
Right. You know, when they came out with that first record, that was a big deal.
Yes. They were more on the more melodic side, but definitely a very important band.
Yeah, I mean...
And they were a bunch of kids, you know? I mean,
yeah, they came right out of that double guitar, Thin mm-hmm. Lizzy kind of a thing.
Thin Lizzy, yeah,
and
definitely.
And it was a great thing to, you know, we were kind of OD'd on the Aerosmith stuff that was being rammed down our throats and, you know, with the format radio that we had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to some extent, it was pretty good, but honestly, you know, bands like Piper and... And, you know, there were so many bands that were just like corporate America and
right.
Corporate American bands. It was an intense breath of fresh air to get involved with the European underground scene, you
right.
know, with bands like Trust from France.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were the bands from Germany, the Scorpions, you know, trying to find their way, you mm-hmm. know, with Uli involved. And it was really interesting to go dig around and... through those import sections, you know, there was I have a lot of records still from those days.
You do? How many records do you think you have?
What now?
Yeah,
not as many. I got a lot. I lost a lot of them. But,
yeah, that happens.
I don't know. What do I got? Probably about 250.
Oh, okay. Yeah, some people, you know, like, I know people.
I still have, like, my old Coliseum 2 stuff with Gary
nice.
Moore. You know, the ancient progressive stuff with Jean-Luc Ponty and Alan Holdsworth.
Love that stuff.
I mean, it was just super progressive. We were all into that because we were musicians. We're, mm-hmm. You know, we're just kids. We couldn't play any of it. We were just like, well, wow.
But you wanted to.
This is what we're supposed to be able to know how to do. Cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, I can think. I can emulate that. But, you know, it got difficult quick.
Sure.
But, you know, with the Ponty records, that was incredible to see Holdsworth harmonizing with the violin the way that worked. It was awesome stuff.
Yeah, that band UK was...
Then the UK.
UK, right,
oh,
yeah.
Man.
That was incredible.
What a performance. Holdsworth, that was
mm-hmm.
the performance of all time, you know.
And then he put out a solo record called Metal Fatigue, which I loved.
Yeah, that was later.
Yeah,
that was after he'd come and hung out in the U.S.
Right,
and got under the wing of Eddie Van Halen for a little while.
Yeah,
but that was I mean,
another great record though.
I'm just thinking of what I still have from like that turning point. You know, 1982. You know, we're all into Saga. When the guys in Amble Chorus were all interested in Saga, and there's a band up near Rush called FM.
Yeah,
in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Rush lives in Toronto.
Right.
That's what that song YYZ is all about.
Yeah,
I didn't know that until...
YYZ is the city code that airlines use.
It's
like, we're SFO.
Right, and they're,
you know,
YYZ.
JFK is in New York City, etc. So that's the three-letter code they use for each airport. And YYZ, for whatever reason, ends up being Toronto. I don't know how they got that, but...
it happens.
Yeah, I mean, JFK, that makes sense. SFO, that makes sense. You know what I mean?
But Honolulu, H-N-O.
Yeah, H-N-O.
LAX.
LAX, you know. Yeah.
Dusseldorf is D-U-S.
Is it? D-U-S, yeah.
D-U-S. But why did they come up with YYZ?
I guess they were running out of, you know, letters by that point, and they just... You know, I think by the time they get to Toronto.
I mean, who else has T T-O-R, or what do you do? T-O-T-O? No, T-O-T?
T-O-T, I don't know.
T-R-O?
Who knows?
Yeah. Somebody's got it, evidently.
There we go.
Yeah.
But dear listeners, you're tortured by Doug's analysis. Doug and Ace's weird
analysis of codes for airports.
Airport names, codes. That's a called going down a weird rat hole there.
So, what do you remember about recording this record, "Victims of Deception," which is a
that?
Really yeah. What do you
remember a lot about it?
Yeah.
We did all the basic tracks at Studio D.
Mm-hmm. Studio D, yeah.
Which is basically all of the all the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And because they have a really nice big room, mm-hmm. and the equipment over there was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
A big what's up to my boy Joel and then, Jaffe and the gang there.
Yeah, we had the guys from Huey Lewis and the News come over and hang out and
nice.
Do some stupid partying. It was hilarious. Good times.
Yeah.
But then we did all the rhythm guitar recording, or a great deal of it, up at a small studio we discovered in Chico, which we did the lion's share of all the rhythm guitars, which was a big deal,
mm-hmm.
because, again, we were trying to get, using that precision I was describing right. earlier, it takes a while, you know, with your headphones going track to track, and that was with 24 track tape.
Right.
So it wasn't like what you can do now. You can speed up the procedure
right.
considerably with Pro Tools.
Yes.
But back then it was like, shit, that's not tight enough. Well, we'll have to do it again.
Right.
Can you punch me in here? And that took on a different meaning. Nowadays, you can punch in pretty effortlessly.
Pretty effortlessly.
Crossfading
yeah.
and yeah. all the good little tricks we have.
Yes.
But, yeah, and that went on for about 2 or 3 weeks. I don't remember exactly. It was about 2 weeks, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And then we brought the whole kit and caboodle back down to a place in Richmond called... what was the name of that place? I want to call Sound Something, Sound Stage, something.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place... it was. I think they've shut down long since... But Metallica was in there preparing to... They were in there writing and preparing to go down to L.A. and record the Black Album. So we were moving in the same day they were moving out, which was kind of hilarious. Got to hang out with the guys a little bit. They had beer in the vending machine, so you could just, like, spend a quarter and get a beer. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So me and James were drinking beers, like Coors Light, I think it was. Weird details, you know?
Yeah.
But that was a pretty good place to do all the rest of the recording. All the solos we did there, guitar solos, vocals. We did all the vocals and solos there, mm-hmm. with the exception of a couple of last little tidbits we did over at Hyde Street, where we mixed. The whole thing was mixed over at Hyde Street.
Hyde Street, yeah. Which is still in existence today. I was just there a couple of weeks ago.
Rob Beaton was the engineer, mm-hmm. and the band itself produced the stuff. We pretty much knew how to go in and knock this out. We wanted to get this tone, so we got the right equipment to do it. It was Mesa Boogie Mark III amplifiers.
Oh, yeah.
And we had all our Jackson guitars with, you know, EMG pickups. And
yeah. These are all kind of standard things at that point. You know, the especially the Mesa Boogies. A lot of people were using Mesa Boogies.
Yeah.
You know, because that gave you a deeper, chunkier tone as opposed to a Marshall.
It's like, you know, I mean, James Hetfield uses them for that reason.
Exactly.
So there's that parallel. But, you know, I did the solos. I think I didn't use that amp. I used my Marshall gear and had this weird Vox amp. And it was a kind of a combination. The tone was both of them. And it's unusual. It's cutting. It sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that was done with the Jackson, the Floyd Rose. And all the rhythm guitars were done with, I think it was Lee's old Heritage V, of which, unbelievably, I've been able to locate ones very similar.
Oh, yeah?
It just happened to be the same, almost the exact same guitar.
Wow.
And I got a deal on it, and I bought it. And it sounds great. It's a Corina V. Anyway, that was... I put EMGs in that one.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have this like beautiful old heritage style guitar with EMG electro death pickups, 81s or whatever it was, and then we used the white Jackson King V for the other side.
Nice.
And carefully layered everything up, and did all the rhythms like that with that arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
The solos were done, like I said, with some Marshall gear and some and Vox stuff. And
that's good. It gives you a little tonal variation.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I liked a little bit of variation. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's kind of it's actually a lot of fun to experiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at, I mean, I enjoy listening to bands like Queen who really go off and go in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. Their talent allows them to be able to try out pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I saw early on with this, with the idea of getting together with Blind Illusion guys, you know, like with mm-hmm. Mark. And Mark is influenced by many different things. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see all these different styles and types come out of him. And it's, I'm not saying anything like, you know, it's a comparison thing, but it's interesting to have someone that doesn't always sound the same. You know, like, he's got some guitar styles that go right in. I mean, he's influenced by so much interesting stuff. He grew up listening to a lot of different kinds of, like, almost country and western kind of mm-hmm. guitar. He's into Roy Rogers. He's into very fast picking stuff that was done by some of these guys, the details of which you'd need to ask him.
Right.
But it's impressive. He'll come right out and play all the stuff.
Yeah.
And so we were always, that was always an interesting thing to try to have a lot on the plate that you could use mm-hmm. in your box of tools, if you will, rather than just like have one massive, brutal, continual onslaught of tone that is, you know, it's the same one after the next song is like equally bludgeoning, tank rolling over your skull.
But
stuff,
what happens is you get ear fatigue
to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's kind of cool to have a little variety.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
After, you know, been there, done that, let's try something different. So that sort of leads us up to where we went with like the direction with the new stuff with this Blind Illusion record.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool. You can hear lots of different elements all over it. I mean, there's examples. It's just like, I don't even know where to start, you know? But it's kind of cool to be able to not be, you know, just to go for it and not really have to sit back and say, oh, well, we got to be heavy here. And it's like, if we're not going to be heavy enough, then we're just, you know.
Yeah.
Really?
No, you got to serve the song. And, you know, you got to give the listener a break, too. And so what I was going to say is, as an educated listener, I like variation in tone. I like variation in tempo. You know, yeah, you got to have the, you can have the brutally bludgeoning, dead-ahead shit. But every once in a while, you got to ease back on the throttle and give listeners' ears a break, for God's sakes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, we did, we're doing a video for this song right now. There's a song on there called Spaced, which is actually probably,
Write that one for me?
Dare I say danceable? I mean, I don't even want to go that far, but I would definitely say
it is more danceable?
In that direction, more than you know, I mean, it doesn't sound like Napalm Death, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting example of where to go. Tom wrote that one, and he's just got his influences too. And it's a lot of fun playing that song for sure. There's no question about it. But it's that song. You know, the lyrics are all about, they're very sci-fi. They're being in it's like we're influenced by that show called The Expanse. So the lyrics are about that.
Nice.
And the video is going to be like that too. And we're in the middle of it right now.
Ooh.
It's pretty cool. Did a lot of spaceship modeling video photography last night.
Oh.
And earlier this week too, trying to figure out exactly where the lighting's going to be and how the green screen's going to work, and a lot of stuff going on.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. Of course, as a sci-fi nut, I mean, my name is...
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, well, The Expanse was during the pandemic when we were like hunkered down with nothing to do except for like, whoa, I think this is a great time to record a new record. So we started, when we all said yes, duh. And we just built out our studios further and started sending files back and forth to each other and starting to compile different types of song ideas and putting them together. And that's kind of how that all worked out. Meanwhile, we were not doing that, we were like binge watching shows like on science fiction and all sorts of different things. One was The Expanse, which was an incredible science fiction show.
I have not seen it.
6 seasons long
of
the best science fiction space